2 Kings chapter 12. You might remember from last week, I would imagine that some of you were not here last week, or you may be visiting, or you may just have a memory like mine, and really appreciate a quick review. Well, last week in chapter 11, we saw a boy in hiding. We saw the king of Judah, the southern kingdom of Judah, Ahaziah, that he was killed. The kingdom of Judah was left without a king because normally his firstborn son would take the throne, but his mom, who happened to be the daughter of Jezebel and Ahab from up in the northern kingdom, decided that she wanted to take power, decided that she wanted the throne, and consequently had all of her grandchildren butchered so that none of them could take the throne. None of them could arise to power. Well, fortunately, Ahaziah's sister, one of his sisters, grabbed the youngest boy. He was just a baby. He still had a nurse. He was about 1 year old. She grabbed him, grabbed the nurse, took the boy and the nurse over to her husband's workplace. Her husband happened to be the high priest. So he was hidden out in the temple. For 6 years he was hidden out in the temple. And when he was 7 years old, the high priest decided it was time to reveal that the king, in fact, had a son, and that the wicked queen, Athaliah, was not the rightful heir to the throne, and got the army guys together, the captains of the hundreds and of the fifties, and got them together and said, okay, let's make a deal here. I will tell you a secret if you will swear loyalty to me. Well, they said, well, of course we're loyal to you. Well, guess what? See this boy, he's the king's son. All right, they said. They got everybody together and they organized what you'd call a protest, maybe. They organized an incident. They got all their guys together there in the temple. They were shoulder to shoulder all the way across the courtyard. Nobody could get in because they had the spears and the shields that David had stored had dedicated to the Lord that had since been stored in the temple. Nobody could get through there. They put them up on Solomon's porch between the two pillars and said, "All right, long live the king." Well, when the queen, who lived right next door, remember the David's palace was right next door to the temple. And so she was living in there, and she heard the noise. She went to tell the neighbors to keep it quiet, and she recognized what was going on. This boy, oh no, oh no, there was one I missed. Well, they grabbed her, dragged her to the horse's entrance of the Davidic palace, and slew her. And so now we see that the king, Joram, 7-year-old boy, has come to the throne. The people have made a covenant before God and said, we will no longer worship the Baal idol or the false god. They tore down the temple to Baal. They killed Baal's high priest. They destroyed all the idols. There was a revival in the land. The people had made a covenant before God. We will be your people and you will be our God. Well, now as we pick up in 2 Kings chapter 12, we see that Joash has grown up to be a man. And generally, he's been a good king, as we see here in the 7th year of Jehu. Jehoash, the long version of Joash, we'll use those terms interchangeably, became king, and he reigned 40 years in Jerusalem. And his mother's name was Tzibiah of Be'er Sheba. And Jehoash did right in the sight of the Lord all his days in which Jehoiada the priest instructed him. So this boy had grown up the first 7 years of his life. He was living at church, literally. He was his dad, his adopted father. In 2 Chronicles, it refers to him as his father. The high priest had discipled him. And once he took the throne, he didn't forsake that upbringing. He continued to have his adopted father, the high priest, instruct him, teach him, encourage him in the ways of the Lord. And it says that he walked with the Lord. It says that he did right in the sight of the Lord all the days that Jehoiada, the high priest, instructed him. Unfortunately, what we're going to see is after Jehoiada, the high priest, after he dies, the guy doesn't take responsibility for his own walk with God. He drifts away from the Lord. falls radically into apostasy even, which is really discouraging, but it's so true of so many lives. We like to think, and you've met people like this, maybe you've been one of these people, got saved early in life, maybe as a junior higher or a high schooler, and you got saved and you read through the New Testament and you were actively going to youth group or church, but you know, then you kind of just stopped. You slept in on a couple Sundays and you didn't like the way youth group was going, so you kind of bailed out, and then it was college and beer and parties, and you know, you just drifted away and you fell away. And when people would confront you about your Christianity, what would you say? Well, oh, I'm saved. I gave my heart to the Lord back in 1974. Yeah, the Bible warns us, the book of Hebrews warns us not to forsake the assembling of ourselves together. In other words, don't fall out of church. Don't get out of fellowship. You need to be instructed in the Word. You need to have that continuous influx of feeding of the Word of life. Because as soon as that passes away out of your life, as soon as that high priest is gone out of your life, what happens? It's all too familiar of a story. Well, we will see that happen at the end of our, near the end of our chapter. But for right now, he's doing well. Right now, he would fall into the column of a good king. And as we've been following the northern kingdom of Israel, we have not had a single king that we would call good. As we've been following the southern kingdom of Judah, there's been a handful, not a whole lot, of kings that we would consider good kings as opposed to bad kings. This guy started out well. He didn't finish well. He was like Samson. He was like the guys that Paul warned about in his letters, about guys who started well and didn't finish well. I pray that you will be a person that finishes well, not forsaking the teaching of the Word, not forsaking the study of the Word, not forsaking prayer to your Lord, but that you will finish well, that you'll be able to say, like Paul said to Timothy in 2 Timothy 4, the last chapter that he ever wrote before he was killed and went to be with the Lord, he said, "Hey, I have finished the race. I've kept the faith. In the future, there is laid up for me the crown of righteousness. I finished it. I did it. I am coming to the end, and I've stayed faithful to the Lord my whole life." Well, we see in verse 3, right now he's being faithful. However, it says in verse 3, only the high places were not taken away. The people still sacrificed and burned incense on the high places. You know, the people had made a covenant with God. "We will be your people. You will be our God. We will be led by godly leadership, by the king that you have appointed, the descendant of David. We will be led by the high priest that you have brought into power, Jehoiada. We will follow him. We will go to temple. We've torn down the Baals." But the high places still existed. Remember, the high places were those hilltops or those mountaintops where various altars would be set up. People might feel a little closer to God, getting back to nature, you might say. Up in the high places, in the groves, there would be a little altar set up to this god or that idol. And they didn't eradicate idolatry from Israel permanently, 100%, completely. They didn't do it. Just a little compromise. Just a little bit. "Oh, I've made a commitment to the Lord, but I still burn incense every once in a while at the high place." How true of our own lives after having committed them, having had a revival in our hearts, after having committed them, our hearts, our lives, our very souls to the Lord. But we just have those few little areas. We've got those little high places. Lord speaks to us. "Hey, I'm not pleased with that. I don't want that in your life." "Well, Lord, it's just a little bit. It's just every once in a while. It's just a little drink. It's just a little movie. It's just a little magazine. Just a little talk. Just a little flirting. Just a little this. Just a little that." What it is, it's a high place. And if it's not torn down, it turns into, what it is compromise. And compromise turns into sin and failure. And so that's what we see. The people will soon enough be all too ready to fall back into their old ways, and they will be judged for it. And so seemingly revivals happening 90% of the way. When we see Jesus lay out church history as he dictates seven letters to seven churches in chapters 2 and 3 of Revelation. As we follow through in church history, when we get to what most scholars believe is the Protestant Reformation, to that church, he says, I have seen your deeds, but they're not complete. They're not complete in my sight. We've seen it, the very Protestant church that we are part of now, the protesters against the Catholic ways, against the idolatry that had crept in, the false doctrine, the selling of indulgences and the papal supremacy and all the rest. When Martin Luther said no and nailed the 95 theses to the Wittenberg door and said, no, this is wrong and this is wrong and this is wrong, God's view on that church age was, you didn't go far enough. You didn't go far enough. You made a commitment to the Lord, but there were still high places. There were still high places. We see it in Israel. We see it in the church at large, and we see it in our own lives. Now is the time to get rid of those things. When we hear a message like this, we get really uncomfortable. I know that you're trying to look alert and maybe even smile, but I know that many of you are going, oh, I hope he doesn't look at me. I know he's talking about that. I know what it is. I don't know what it is. But see, the Spirit of God illuminating that. If you're sitting here going, oh man, my high place, it's getting caught. It's being revealed. Don't hide that. Don't hide it. Give it up to the Lord. Lord, I know. I know my behavior's been wrong. I know my attitude's been wrong. I know my heart has got that high place in there. Let that nervousness be recognized as conviction. And give it up to the Lord. Now's a great time to do it. Tear down that high place. The Israelites didn't do it. These people from the kingdom of Judah, the high places, they were still sacrificing. They were still burning incense there in the high places. Well, Jehoash said to the priests in verse 4, all the money of the sacred things which is brought into the house of the Lord, in current money, the money of each man's assessment, and all the money which any man's heart prompts him to bring into the house of the Lord, let the priests take it for themselves, each from his acquaintance, and they shall repair the damage of the house wherever any damage may be found. Well, King Joash or Jehoash knew that the temple was in bad shape. It was in disrepair. I think it was 114 years, give or take a few years, before that Solomon had built and dedicated the temple. Over 100 years. But in that last 100 years, glorious as it was, expensive as it was, as labor intensive as it was, it had seen better days. Because remember, the enemies of Israel had come in and looted at various times. It had been attacked. It had fallen into disrepair, even because the priests themselves had fallen into apostasy, many of them. When the worship of Baal and his temple became took precedence over the temple of God, things just fell apart. You know, the paint started peeling and things started breaking, and it looked bad. Well, King Joash, being instructed in the ways of the Lord, doing what's right in the sight of the Lord right now, looks around and says, man, we need to fix this place up. Okay, he tells the priest, I want you to take an offering. I want you to take the money that comes in, and I want you to fix this place up. Probably the worst thing that happened to it was just before this reign and rule of Joash, the queen mother, his grandmother, she and her sons had looted the place. We read in the parallel passage in 2 Chronicles 24:7. 24:7, I like that. 2 Chronicles 24:7, easy enough to remember that one. For the sons of the wicked Athaliah had broken into the house of God and even used the holy things of the house of the Lord for the Baals. They'd taken the pitchers and the bowls and the various implements and instruments and vessels and carried them on over to the Baal temple. Oh, we can use these over here. No sense making new ones. They broke into the house of God. They broke into the house of God. That amazes me. It amazes me that we have to have insurance on all our stuff because people break into a house of God. I was waiting to testify, about 2 years ago, to be a character witness for a man that had violated probation. And as I was watching guy after guy come forward, there was a guy who stood before the judge that had been arrested on a parole violation. You know what he had done? He had broken into one of the local churches here and stolen all the microphones. Can you imagine? I don't believe that judge could have sentenced him to anything compared to what was waiting for him in the throne room of God. I can't imagine. It was all I could do to sit still during that. Well, these guys broke into the house of God, trashed it, stole stuff. The house of God, the temple, was in bad shape. Well, King Yehoash, he says, guys, when you take the money, I want you to use it to fix it up. And that money was to come from three different places. That money was to come from three different sources. And what I'd like to do actually is cover them in reverse order. Reverse order from what they're giving. The third thing listed is that giving which was prompted by the heart. The giving that was prompted by the heart. The free will offering. As somebody's heart moved them, they just said, oh man, it's on my heart to rebuild the temple of God. I just want to give this for the work of God here in this building. Well, this is the best giving, near as I can tell in the Bible, this is the best kind of giving there is. That free will offering that people just say, you know what? God was moving my heart and I just gave. I just felt moved to give. It's like we talked about the other Sunday in Exodus 35, when the original temple, the tabernacle, the portable tent temple, was to be built for the first time. God told Moses, hey, take up an offering. But it was not to be mandatory. It wasn't, okay, everybody, 6.5 shekels for everybody who could walk. You know, it wasn't like that. It was just whoever is willing, whoever had a heart to give, those were the people that would give. We see in verse 21 of Exodus 35, everyone whose heart stirred him and everyone whose spirit moved him came and brought the Lord's contribution for the work of the tent of meeting. It was just that free will offering. Paul the Apostle made that same point to the Corinthians in 2 Corinthians 9, saying, hey, let each one do just as he has purposed in his own heart. I try and exhort that to people every single Sunday morning, just as you have purposed in your own heart, not grudgingly or giving under compulsion. For God loves a cheerful giver. That word, as you know, means hilarious. God loves a hilarious giver. That's the offering that blesses the Lord. Not when somebody visits church or maybe he's been coming for a while and they see that basket coming and they see that deacon and, oh man, I was going to use this for lunch, you know, and digging into their pocket and grabbing the fiver and putting it in there because they know people are watching. Hey, God would prefer that you spend the five on lunch because he wants you to give hilariously. He wants you to say, God, you are so good. Oh, man, I'm delighted. It's a privilege for me to give this to you. Bless you, Lord. That's what he wants. That's the only money that he wants when the offering is taken, is that which is given of a cheerful heart, of a joyful, hilarious heart. And so that free will offering, that which is just giving prompted by the heart. Well, the next thing, the second thing is, it says the money of each man's assessment. Even though there were free will offerings, don't forget that there was the assessment that people were obligated to give their what was assessed, to give a certain percentage. We call it the tithe. Tithe literally means 10%. But actually, if you total up all the tithes of different times in the year, it totals between 23 and 26% of their yearly income would go directly to the work of God. And so I'd like to institute something new. Wow. We won't consider you a member unless you're doing that. Don't you praise God that we don't have membership? Oh, man. Remember Herbert W. Armstrong, the Worldwide Church of God, started out as a cult. And they said, if you pledge double tithes, 20% of your income, when the Lord comes back, we will send you a telegram. Seriously, I'm not making this up. We will send you a telegram where we are in the wilderness where the Lord's coming back. But you had to tithe 20%. So I'm thinking maybe an email program. I'll tell you when the Lord comes back. Isn't it amazing that people fall for that stuff? It's just, it's so plain. When you get taught the pure word of God, it's just so easy to discern those things. If they had just been being taught through the word, they would have recognized, telegram, 20%? What are you talking about? I'm out of here. Well, they did pay tithes. 23 to 26% of their annual income went to the work of God. And that's where this money was coming from too, the assessment. God unfortunately had to rebuke the Israelites many, many times for failing to give what was the Lord's. And it was, in fact, the Lord's. The tithe belonged to the Lord. It was not theirs to keep and do with as they pleased. It belonged to God. And by the time of the prophet Malachi, in Malachi 3, the Lord spoke to the people through Malachi and said, will a man rob God? Oh, we would never think of holding a gun to God and saying, all right, with the wallet, I want the cattle on 1,000 hills. I want all of it. I want the watch. Oh, no time in heaven, no watch. Okay, but I want all the rest. You know, it's ludicrous to think that you could rob God. But God said they were robbing him. He said, you were robbing me. But you say, well, how have we robbed thee? He says, in tithes and offerings. You are cursed with a curse, for you are robbing me, the whole nation of you. Bring the whole tithe into the storehouse, that there may be food in my house. And see if I will not open up for you the floodgates of heaven and pour out upon you so much blessing, you won't have room for it. God said, you're robbing me, but if you're faithful, I will bless you so abundantly. You won't be able to sit down because your wallet will be so full. You will not be able to close the door to your barn because it will be so full of grain. But you need to demonstrate that trust in me, that faith in me. Well, you might say, where are you going with this, Ron? Are you saying that we need to institute the tithe? No, many Christians are certainly quick and eager to point out, we're not under the law. And we're not under the law. Grace, in theory, is supposed to supersede the law. But certainly the principle remains the same. The principle is that God has entrusted stewardship of finances to us. And if we've refused to acknowledge him with a portion of that being given back, what would God say to us? What has God said to the Israelites for the same purpose? Am I saying, hey man, you got to take 23 or 26 or even 10% of that paycheck and do that? Hey, some people do. You'd be surprised how many people do. And I would be remiss if I did not encourage you to pray about that and say, Lord, what would you have me give back to you in thanksgiving, in offering? I say, hey, I heard Calvary Chapel doesn't talk about money. Not out of context, but certainly when we go through the Word of God and several places in the Word, this one being a great example, where God encouraged the people, give to the house of God. Well, we also see that the current money was the third thing, the current money. Actually, let me back up too, because somebody said, I left my NIV at home today, and I promised them that I would slam the NIV. How many of you are reading NIVs today? There you go. What did the NIV say for the assessment? Vows? Was it vows? Anybody? Nobody's reading. Was it the vows, fulfillment of their vows? That's just a bad translation. Look it up. It was the assessment. It was what they were assessed for redeeming the firstborn, for the tithes, for the vows that they had made. Everything that falls into that category is what they were obligated to give under the law. So, again, I apologize if you're reading, or should I say I'm sorry that you're reading the NIV. Okay, I got my slam in, but next I'm gonna praise the NIV. How about that? Thirdly, we see the current money. The third thing, or in reality, the first thing on this was in current money. That word literally means to cross over. To cross over, the crossover money. What does that mean? Well, when a boy crossed over into adulthood, When he was 19 and he had his 20th birthday, he crossed over into adulthood. Now, that carried with it all the rights and privileges of adulthood. For example, hey, I get to go off to war now. Hey, I get counted in the census. But every man who was counted in the census was obligated to give a half shekel of silver. So just like people today look forward to their 18th birthday or their 21st birthday, well, when the guy was 19, his 20th birthday was coming up, he's going, man, now I got to pay a half a shekel. And it didn't matter. The word said if you were rich or you were poor, if you got counted in the sentence or census, you had to give half a shekel. So it would cross over. So that's why the NIV says the money collected in the census, even though it's not literally what it says, it's a great rendition of what that means. So am I back on your good side? Yeah. Okay. Something else to point out, by the way, through the Old Testament, through the Pentateuch, the first five books of the Bible, penned by Moses, it seems very clear that it was the 20-year-olds who were held accountable. Those who were 19 and under, it seems that they were not obligated to go to war. They were not held accountable for their sin. They were not counted as adults or counted in the census. And so many of us, we think, man, my 6.5-year-old, I know he's at the age of accountability. Smite him, Lord, smite him. You don't pray like that? Shame on you. We often think, oh man, my junior high schooler, if he or she does that one more time, oh man, I'm afraid for their soul. But it seems that so-called age of accountability, not a biblical term, but something that we have said is basically the theory of somehow children are sanctified by their believing parents. We know that from Corinthians. We know that from David, whose son died, and David knew he was going to heaven. They're sanctified by their parents because they're not at a place yet, whether they're 2 years old or however old they are, they're not in a place to say, Lord, I'm a sinner. I recognize the wickedness of my heart, and I'm praying that you would come into my life. And so it would seem that there's this age of accountability, this cutoff, let's call it a crossover, where God begins to hold each person accountable. Well, my personal belief is one of two things, and you could take this to the bank and get nothing for it. But my personal belief is either that age of accountability crosses over from 19 to 20, or that God individualizes it for each person. That God would see a 7-year-old and say, I have revealed your sin to you. You need to walk with me. Or there could be somebody who is not mentally able to comprehend, and they're 45 years old, and it's possible that God would not hold them accountable because they could not know. That I lean more in that direction, but I can't tell you for sure. I can tell you this. When we're in heaven and we're seeing God's judgments, every one of them, we're going to be saying, right on, righteous and true are your judgments, Lord. I know that God is going to be fair. He's going to be loving. He's going to be merciful. But you, be fair and loving and merciful, maybe if you've got teenagers at home. And maybe cut them a little bit of slack spiritually, not to not disciple them, but maybe I should say cut yourself some slack, relieve that ulcer a little bit, and go, okay, Lord, I'm sure they're still young enough to turn to you. Well, we see that they were to get it from those three places, from the current money that taken in the census, the each man's assessment, all the tithes and the dedications and the firstborn offerings and the vows, all those things, and then finally the free will, the money that any man's heart prompted him to bring into the house of the Lord. The priests were supposed to take that, use that money to buy building materials and fix things up. Well, what we see in verse 6 is that it came about that in the 23rd year of King Jehoash, the priests had not repaired the damages of the house. Then King Jehoash called for Jehoiada the priest and the other priests and said to them, why do you not repair the damages of the house? Now therefore, take no more money from your acquaintances, but pay for it from the damages, for the damages of the house. So the priests agreed that they should take no more money from the people, nor repair the damages of the house. One thing that we see in 2 Chronicles that doesn't come out specifically is that God had told them to... I could have sworn I wrote this in my notes, and I'm just not seeing it. But I know that in 2 Chronicles 24, it just disappeared. Okay, we'll do this from memory. A long time ago... No, in 2 Chronicles 24, in this parallel story, God told them to take from their acquaintances, and we also see that even right here in verse 5 and in verse 7. Now, your NIVs, your NIVs say what? Taken from the treasurers. But, am I right? I'm doing this from memory now. Taken from the treasurers. It's not from the treasurers. Look that word up in Hebrew. It means friend or acquaintance. Friend or acquaintance. In 2 Chronicles 24, when we see the parallel passage, the king had told them to go out into the cities of Judah and collect money from all Israel. See, this wasn't just a hang out and wait. This was supposed to be a building program. This was supposed to be a building project. You guys need to go out and hold those people locally that you ministered to accountable. You need to go and let them know this is the need, and you need to, number one, fulfill your obligations. Number two, make sure that you're praying and saying, Lord, would you have me do this? They weren't to get it from the treasurers. This was a direct connection. This was the people that they grew up around. These were the people that they ministered to on a regular basis in their own local hometowns. The people that they ministered to, those were the people that were supposed to be giving. It just reminds me of one more thing. It just tells me one more thing that the televangelists do wrong. Those blind blanket appeals across the airwaves to everyone in the United States, send money. Please, wait, we're almost off the air. And that's so wrong. Because it's the local ministry, it's the local church that is supposed to be benefiting first and foremost. It's not the treasurers, it's the acquaintances, it's the friends, it's the people that are being ministered to face on. I remember at a pastor's conference, one of the guys was sharing that went off to the East Coast to plant a Calvary Chapel there when there was no Calvary Chapels on the East Coast, told the story about how he would, what a nightmare his first few years were, as they would sit there in their church building, and there was a guy who, and don't you even think about imitating this, there was a guy who would come in to church, and he would sit in the front row, and about, a few minutes, 10 minutes into the message, he would stand up and walk out and go to the store next door and buy a big bag of carrots. This was a regular Sunday thing that he did. And walk back into the sanctuary all the way down. By the way, that really bothers me when you do that. Forget the carrots. I don't mind you coming back in, but don't come back in and walk down the aisle and sit in the very front row. Now, especially don't do this with the carrots, okay? Because then this guy would open up the bag of carrots. And he would offer them to the people around him. Well, the carrots thing has nothing to do with where we're at, but the next thing does. He said that the church was struggling. The offerings were like $10 a week, even though people were there. And there was a lady who was fairly wealthy, an elderly widow that was fairly wealthy. And as he's shaking hands at the door, she said something to the effect of, "Oh, I'm just so ministered to here at Calvary Chapel, and almost as much as I am by that dear man Kenneth Copeland. And I send my whole tithe to Kenneth Copeland every week." You know, and he's sitting there, and they're struggling, and they're eating lettuce soup for dinner, you know. And I send my tithe to Kenneth Copeland Ministries. How discouraging! That the biblical principle is those who are the acquaintances, those who are being ministered to, you know. Anyway, if that's where your tithe is going, hey, bless you. Just don't tell me, okay? I don't have a clue where we are at this point. Oh, each from his acquaintances. So it turned out that after a period of years, the king looked out his window and thought, boy, this building project is really going slow. It seems like nothing, as a matter of fact, nothing. They haven't done a single thing. So he calls the high priest. He calls all the priests together and says, what are you guys doing? You've been taking the money all this time, but you haven't been repairing what? Okay, here's the deal. Stop. Stop taking the money. You're not allowed to take the money anymore. And stop this whole facade of repairing. I don't want you guys repairing anymore. So they agreed that they wouldn't take any more money or repair the damages. It was only half difficult because they weren't repairing it in the first place. But Jehoiada the priest took a chest and bored a hole in its lid and put it beside the altar on the right side as one comes into the house of the Lord. And the priests who guarded the threshold put in all the money which was brought into the house of the Lord. And when they saw that there was much money in the chest, the king's scribe and the high priest came up and tied it in bags and counted the money which was found in the house of the Lord. And they gave the money which was weighed out into the hands of those who did the work, who had the oversight of the house of the Lord, and they paid it out to the carpenters and the builders who worked on the house of the Lord, and to the masons and to the stone cutters and for buying timber and hewn stone to repair the damages to the house of the Lord, and for all that was laid out for the house to repair it. So King Joash, or Jehoash, had delegated this responsibility, had said, okay, guys, you're responsible. Collect this money, repair the house of the Lord. They hadn't done it. They hadn't done it. For years, people have been bugging me, delegate, delegate, delegate. Ron, you're going to burn yourself out. You need to delegate. A couple years ago, Judy and I had what we called the year of delegation, where we just began to recognize, okay, here's the way the ministry should go, and we're going to burn ourselves out, so let's start delegating. And, you know, let's just be honest here, I'm a perfectionist and a workaholic. And so when I delegate something, I just assume it'll be done. You managers at work, you know what I'm talking about. And so often it doesn't get done. You expect that it's going to be done timely and done well. And I realize it's not always going to be done the way I want it to do, or I would have done it, or I would have expected it, but timely and done well. But it doesn't happen. And you who are in positions at work of having to delegate, you know what I'm talking about. It's like, hey, that's coming up, you know, next week, you know, how are you doing? You didn't want to patronize them. You didn't want to babysit them or show that you didn't trust them. And so you just let them run with the ball. And it turned out that as soon as you gave it to them, they put the ball under their desk and forgot about it. And then what happens? You're stuck doing it yourself. Because the fact is, it was something that needed to be done. And now you've got to do it yourself. And so how frustrating that is. So I don't have a problem doing what Jehoash did. I don't like to be the least popular guy, but it happens. And so you have to take that responsibility back and you say, you know, you let me down. I needed that done. You didn't do it. So you have one of two choices. You either take care of it yourself or you delegate that out to somebody else. Well, Jehoash did both, actually. He did part of it himself. He delegated the other part of it. As far as the money collections go, we're going to get a big chest and we're going to drill a hole in it. And he did all that himself and drag it over next to the altar, the altar of sacrifice where the offerings were lifted up. There was no getting around it. As soon as you walked in, you saw the altar of sacrifice. And right there on the right was the chest where the money went in for the offering. So he did that part himself. What he delegated out was the rest. He delegated out the counting of the money, his scribe and... Who else was that? Was that the high priest that counted that? I know his scribe counted it. And the high priest came up and they counted it and they tied it in bags and did that. And then, because the priests had not been faithful, they gave it to the carpenters, to the contractors, to the stone cutters. They gave the money directly to them and said, you buy the materials, you do the work. And they proved to be faithful. As a matter of fact, it said that there wasn't even any accounting needed. In verse 13, it says, they were not made for the house of the Lord, silver cups, snuffers, bowls, trumpets, any vessels of gold or silver from the money, which was brought into the house of the Lord, because they gave that to those who did the work, and with it they repaired the house of the Lord. So there wasn't enough money coming in for all the gold and silver stuff that had been stolen. But it says, moreover, they did not require an accounting from the men into whose hand they gave the money to pay to those who did the work, for they dealt faithfully. Guess what? You had priests and you had contractors. Who was more faithful with the money? Ouch. It was the contractors. They didn't even say, hey, give me a balance sheet. I need to see where this money's going, because they were faithful. The priests, on the other hand, hadn't done a thing. And we hear about that happening locally, regionally, nationally, about ministers who are not faithful with what they've been entrusted. But then we know so many Christians that are faithful. What we would call your average Joe. You know, they're not standing up behind a pulpit. They're just doing labor 5 or 6 days a week, caring for their families and being faithful with the money that God entrusts to them. That's a shame to the priesthood. That's a shame to every minister that is found to be less faithful than your average Joe who's just working and being faithful to the Lord. Well, that was the case here. These guys hadn't acted quickly, so the chest was put in. The people offered their offerings, and the work was done by the contractors. It says the money from the guilt offerings and the money from the sin offering, we're in verse 16, was not brought into the house of the Lord. It was for the priests. So even though the priests hadn't been faithful, they still stuck to the word of God, which said that the priests, those who ministered, were supposed to be provided for by the offering. So these two offerings, the guilt offering and the sin offering, when people gave in regards to that, the priests used that money for their own salary, their own pay. They didn't have access to all that money that was in the chest, but they got their paycheck and they were cared for. It's certainly a biblical principle. We know that First Corinthians 9, Paul told the Corinthians that the Lord directed those who proclaim the gospel should get their living from the gospel. And Jesus said when he sent out the guys, and remember, he sent them out by twos into the various places. He said, don't take any money with you. People will take care of you. You know, find a house, find who is worthy. And he says, stay in that house, eat and drink what they give you, for the laborer is worthy of his wages. Hey, if you go out and minister, it's not too much to expect that people will care for you as you're ministering to them. It's a biblical principle. But these guys didn't have the excess anymore. Before, they were living like televangelists, weren't they? They were taking all that money for themselves instead of blessing the ministry. It was all going into their bank accounts, buying their suits and their Cadillacs and their Rolex watches and all the rest. And that was not right. We know that leadership in the house of God is supposed to be above reproach and prudent and respectable and free from the love of money. And they're supposed to have a good reputation with those outside the church. Well, these guys hadn't done any of it. They weren't fired. They just were regulated. So we see in verse 16 that the money... Oh, we just saw that in verse 16. Then we see in verse 17, Hazael, the king of Aram, he went up and fought against Gath and captured it. And Hazael set his face to go up to Jerusalem. And Jehoash, king of Judah, took all the sacred things that Jehoshaphat and Jehoram and Ahaziah, his fathers, kings of Judah, had dedicated, and his own sacred things, and all the gold that was found among the treasuries of the house of the Lord and of the king's house, and sent them to Hazael, king of Aram. Then he went away from Jerusalem. What in the world happened to this guy? He just spent years on this building project, just spent years telling people, man, we got to build up the house of the Lord. And here, the king of Aram, what we know of as today is Syria, comes in and threatens to attack, and he takes all the things of value and sends it out as like a bribe of, here, you can have all our stuff, just don't hurt us. What happened to this guy? Where's his faith? Well, what 2 Chronicles 24 tells us that this doesn't was between verses 16 and 17, something happened. Jehoiada, the high priest, he died. And that spiritual mentor that King Jehoash had was no longer there. And instead of being accountable for his own walk with God, he looked to the next set of people. Who were the next set of people that came in and seemed to minister to him? Well, it was the officials, the elders of Israel. We see that in 2 Chronicles 24, in verse 17, says that after the death of Jehoiada, the officials of Judah came and bowed to the king, and the king listened to them. A little bit of flattery, a little bit of, oh, king, you're so great. Hey, check out what we have to say. And it says they abandoned the house of the Lord, the God of their fathers. They served the Asherim and the idols. So wrath came upon Judah and Jerusalem for this, their guilt. the king fell into apostasy. God was faithful. God was faithful to warn him. God never brings about judgment without warning first. And he did warn them. He sent them prophets. It says, as you continue on in verse 19 of 2 Chronicles 24, it says that he sent prophets to them to bring them back to the Lord. Though they testified against them, they would not listen. These guys had it on their heart as the Spirit led them, saying, King, officials, turn back to the Lord. Remember the covenant you made with God. Remember the commitment that you made to serve the Lord. They didn't want any part of it. They didn't want to listen. They were having too much fun. And let's face it, worship of idols is fun. You might say, well, that's what's so big about that? I mean, you know, you go to the temple and worship God, go to the temple of Baal and you worship Baal. What's really the difference? Well, they made sure that idolatry was fun. It was sexually very satisfying. The immorality and the debauchery of it all, man, you couldn't wait to go. So it was very appealing. So when they were caught up in this carnality, they didn't want to listen to, oh God, come back to holiness, come on. They didn't want to hear it. Well, they didn't want to hear it so much that it says that the son of Jehoiada, the high priest, King Joash's father, spiritual father and mentor, the son who was a prophet, Zechariah, he stood above the people and said to them, thus God has said, why do you transgress the commandments of the Lord and do not prosper? Because you have forsaken the Lord, he has also forsaken you. So they conspired against him. At the command of the king, they stoned him to death in the court of the house of the Lord. This guy spent the first 7 years of his life being trained by the high priest, being raised up in that very temple, and walked with the Lord and spent years making sure that the house of the Lord was built back up. But when he fell into apostasy, he ordered the death of who would be a spiritual brother. His mentor's own son had him killed right there in the temple for preaching the word of God. Well, it says, thus Joash the king did not remember the kindness which his father Jehoiada had shown him, but he murdered his son. And as he died, as Zechariah died, he said, may the Lord see and avenge. Well, God did. God did, because Hazael comes in. We find out as you continue on into 2 Chronicles 24. And I would recommend that you read these side by side. But it says that at the turn of the year, the army of the Arameans did come up against him. And they came to Judah and Jerusalem, destroyed all the officials of the people from among the people, and sent all their spoil to the king of Damascus. Indeed, the army of the Arameans came with a small number of men, yet the Lord delivered a very great army into their hands, because they had forsaken the Lord, the God of their fathers. Thus they executed judgment on Joash. The Syrians, the Arameans, they came up, they didn't have a huge army. And apparently, Joash probably thought, well, I got a great big army here. We'll just go out and stomp all over them. And they were defeated. That little band of Arameans defeated all the Israelites. That's why he panicked. He had no way to turn to God. He was distant from God and not knowing what else to do. Oh, man, he beat me. Sent out all the valuables from his own house and from the house of the Lord. So before, he was dogmatically set on the restoration of the temple. And now he's looting it to save his own hide. So, verse 19. It says, now the rest of the acts of Joash and all that he did, are they not written in the book of the Chronicles of the Kings of Judah? You're saying, yeah, Ron just read half of it to me just now. Well, and his servants arose and made a conspiracy and struck down Joash at the house of Millo as he was going down to Silah. 4. Yozakar, the son of Shemath, and Yehosabad, the son of Shomer, killed him. His servants struck him, and he died. And they buried him with his fathers in the city of David, and Amaziah, his son, became king in his place. Well, again, if you look at 2 Chronicles 24, you find out the motivation, the reason behind this assassination. They were incensed. The servants of the king were incensed that he had commanded that Zechariah, the son of his spiritual mentor, had ordered him stoned, ordered him put to death in the temple, no less. this guy can't be king. This guy has fallen into apostasy. And so they killed him. Well, next week when we get to chapter 13, we're going to go back up north to the kingdom of Israel and see that things are faring even worse up there. That's what you've come to expect from the nation of that northern kingdom. Let's go to the Lord in prayer tonight.